He's holding a miniature dining table, mahogany with bulbous legs. There are name cards arranged along its length and breadth. You'll be sitting there, madam, with your back to the windows. Sir, you'll be here, opposite your wife. Typically, I forget immediately. It's all too much. Even the front door had opened before we'd managed to knock, like Downing Street. Someone approaches the step and the door opens. Maybe there's a buzzer under the mat. What will you have to drink, madam? I don't know. Half a bitter? Sherry? Gin and tonic. By far the safest until I know the score. Tim and I look at each other with glazed eyes. I mean, how do you make the transition? From a quick half in the pub to this. We're ushered into the sitting room. There's a small group of people listening to Mrs. Captain. Best to stand still and speak when we're spoken to. And then, of course, we were stuck in Jib for a fortnight. Thank goodness the governor was in residence. We were penniless, not a bean. Then she spots us. Ah, the potters! A steward gives us our drinks at the point of shaking hands. Quick change from right to left, slop, slop, and how lovely to meet you at long last. I hear you found a flat. I'm sure it's utterly charming. There isn't an ugly building in the whole town. Other couples arrive. We don't know anybody. The husbands are nearly all naval. I'm still learning ranks by the number of rings on the jacket. I can't seem to listen. I sip and nod. I've never seen so many Staffordshire figures. And a fat Labrador. I've heard about the Labradors. I mustn't grin. Someone will notice. Just before lunch, the captain arrives. Bruce, ruddy-faced, big voice like Mrs. Captain. Perfect timing as ever, he says. I nod. More introductions. Mrs. Captain is incredible. Not one hesitation. She got us all off pat. And here we have Mr. and Mrs. Potter, darling. Luckily, Tim remembers where to sit. He rolls his eyes to the space opposite. We're exactly in the middle. The padre, very clipped, says, for good food, thank God. No messing about with for what we are about to receive and all that. One of my naval companions has recently returned from Singapore, the other from the Med. We've just moved down from Holland Park, I tell them. I can't think of anything else to say that could possibly interest them. Best to shut up. I suppose I'm being rude, but I'm far more interested in Mrs. Captain. She's telling her attentive group at the top of the table that she'd been a messenger during the war. I see her immediately on a horse with a flowing mane, then realise that she's talking about London and the Second World War. So I put her in Jeep, wearing a jaunty peaked cap. Not a bit of it. I had an absolutely whiz motorbike. Purred when I wanted it to, roared when I meant business. I wore a brown leather helmet and goggles and the most enormous pair of gauntlets. I look down the other end of the table. I can see why the captain fell for this loud madcap woman. I'm mesmerized. My companions have given up on me and chat across me. I don't care. Until, that is, I see that everyone has finished their main course except me. And Mrs. Captain, who's pushing a few peas around her plate. I put my knife and fork together. And by magic, the stewards enter and remove our plates. How do they know? There seems to be a lot of magic. Stewards floating in the moment I put my pudding spoon down. Incredible. I decline coffee in the sitting room and am glad of the fresh air when we're ushered out. We have beans on toast for supper. A cheap day. Oh, Lizzie. I can't believe This is the 60s. It's more like 1933. And I'm having to learn things fast. Some things I know very well, like starting from the outside bits of cutlery and working inwards. Father taught us things like that. You know the sort of good manners I'm talking about. Tilting the soup bowl and not slurping. He'd say, "I hear you like soup." He wanted us all to talk like the announcers on the BBC. "This is the Home Service. Here is the news." I pride myself I'm good at accents and dialect. When I was an actress in Weekly Rep, it was a requirement. That was before the theatre gave me up, of course. So speaking posh isn't difficult. The problem is how to sustain it. I mean, will I have to learn to talk posh for the rest of my life in this place? A daunting thought. Tim has this charming way of talking. He looks and sounds sincere, and his soft voice has only the slightest trace of the Lakes. Where we come from, you want to drop your accent as soon as possible. Anyway, when we're settled down with our beans on toast in front of the telly, he tells me I was wonderful at the lunch and that he's proud of me. One of the officers told him I looked an A1 sort of girl. I said, "Should we invite them back here for a lunch?" He says, "I think we should wait a while." The mantelpiece now has a row of white cards with gold edges. "Mrs. Honor Smith at home, Commander and Mrs. Maliphant request the pleasure of your company," etc., etc. At least two a week for the next month or so. We don't know these people. Well, Tim has met the husbands, of course, but I'm only just starting on the round of coffee mornings. I discover very quickly that all the wives are excellent cooks, flower arrangers, and small talkers. The conversations at table are mainly anecdotal. We don't talk about politics, sex, or religion. That happens in the grander houses when the ladies are ushered upstairs to powder their noses and the men are left to the serious business of adult chit-chat and joke-telling over brandy and cigars. We have our second lunch with Tim's head of department. We're asked to stay behind on the latter occasion for a further cup of coffee. Obviously, we're their favourite guests. This must be some sort of breakthrough. He rambles a bit about a couple who'd been around in the 50s. "They were frightfully poor," he says. "In the end, they declined all invitations to lunch and dinner until they found themselves able to reciprocate." I'm not sure I'm settling very well in this place. People are charming in their own homes. They make us so welcome and lavish such generous hospitality. In the market or the wardroom anteroom, they seem to hold back, and I wonder what I've done wrong. I'll catch sight of them and wave or call out hello. The most I get back is a wan smile. Mostly, it's a total lack of recognition. Am I so insignificant? Do I only exist as an adjunct of Tim? I wish, more than anything, that I could be Mrs. Captain. She is everything I long to be. She commands respect. She's got hair like the Queen, and she could talk about absolutely anything. And she's got a loud laugh. My laughter is internal. When I'm convulsed by laughter, I might emit a long wheeze like Joey Brown in Some Like It Hot. Tim is very sensible. "You should make a really big effort to talk more, my precious." He's right. "And you should do something about your moustache." Moustache? I rush to the mirror. I can't see any moustache. I mean, I've seen women who have black hairs, and some who actually do have a dark coloured down on their upper lip. But he's quite right. If I turn my head a little so that a shadow falls on the hair, it does look quite dark. I buy depilatory cream immediately and apply it. I now have a red, shiny, spotty upper lip in the shape of a moustache. It lasts several days and it smarts. I have to decline an invitation to the commanders. Tim goes alone. I want to go home. I don't know why, but I do. I mean, I don't have a home anymore. My parents are dead, but I want to go back to the idea of home, to my grandfather's house where I was safe. Not my father's side of the family. That was antique, polished furniture and lace table mats. Keep your elbows in. Have a cigar, Charlie, and let the women see the photographs of our cruise. No, I want to sit wrapped in a shawl with my dada, my mother's father, and eat bread and milk in a basin, drink tea from the saucer, and toast cheese in front of the fire, the oil dripping onto an enamel plate. I expect that sounds like a massive retreat into the womb or something. Find me an umbilical cord and I'll grab it. No, no. One day, I'm going to be like Mrs. Captain. Really. But you have to be careful, Lizzie. Not to get too involved. Every 2 years it's all changed, you see. That happens in the Navy. You attempt some kind of friendship with some of them, and as soon as you begin to feel comfortable, they're off. It's like belonging to a global club. Didn't you overlap our tour in Singapore? You two are following us like a bad penny. Another 2 years of dreadful hangovers, I suppose. We're staying forever. We're civilians, so we never pass go. I find it very hard to adjust. I've come to the conclusion that you have to be a very special person to get involved with the Navy. To survive, you must make and break friendships quickly and without regret. Learn the rules and know when to shut up. As you move up the ranks, you know what to expect and what is your right. You go to a higher grade carpet in your quarter and you probably have an exterior light. We're going up in the world, honey bunch. We've got a downstairs lab. 25 quid a square meter for the commander's curtains, mate. 12.50 for a lieutenant. Mrs. Captain Mark II collects icons and small painted statues that look sort of religious. I'm not talking about plaster virgins with glass eyes or statues of the Bleeding Heart. These are wooden with peeling paint and gilt. Very expensive, I should think. I wouldn't mind having them. Here we are again at lunch. The sitting room has the same issue carpets and sofas, but the walls are a different shade of tasteful. Mrs. Captain is, well, stylish. She wears dark glasses. I think that's very clever. She can cover up all kinds of mistakes, like... Actually, I meant Camilla, not you, Matty. I do know who you are. And I wish she didn't. I can't really see, but I feel she's eyeing my lumpy tummy. I should have had a shampoo and set, but the babes were so grisly this morning. I should have stayed at home. I can't blame Tim for leaving me here. I think that's the captain's secretary he's talking to. Another stylish one. One good thing about Harold Wilson is the Open University. Tim's very excited about it. I think if you look into it, my sweetest one, you might find a course to suit you. I don't think you're dim. That's not what I'm saying at all. I just think you need stretching. Especially now you're housebound with the kids. Can't have you turning into a cabbage. Mrs. Captain is smiling. I expect the little ones take up all your time, Matty. I'm going red. I can feel it. I say, good Lord, no. They're frightfully good. In fact, I teach 2 afternoons a week, and I'm directing a play for the town players. Nannies are a godsend, aren't they? And in no time, you'll be packing them off to prep school. I know I'm still red. We don't have a nanny, and we won't be sending them away. Clearly a modern woman. Matty, you're a marvel. She's gone to talk to some of her cronies. I feel I'm being laughed at. Well, look at this table. Pale green linen mats, green plates, green soup, green sauce, green spinach, green watercress, the pudding, green mint mousse. We're sitting in the middle of the table, and I talked to a lieutenant who served on Fearless when Wilson met Ian Smith. Quick lecture to self, don't talk politics. So what is it like to be part of history? He looks down his nose. All part of the job. And it was hardly a successful encounter. Oh? Why do you say that? What this country needs is a good old-fashioned statesman. The less said about that, the better. Quite, is all I can manage to say. I put my pudding spoon down and the stewards swoop in immediately to clear it away. Magic. Mrs. Captain is talking quietly. Sophisticated lady. I want to be like her. She is so... My great-aunt gave me a white damask tablecloth. It belonged to her mother, so it must be at least 100 years old. I also picked up a silver-plated candelabra in a closing-down sale, and I bought a rose bowl in a jumble sale. I'm all set for a series of disastrous dinner parties. We practice on people we've got to know fairly well over the last couple of years, but I'm so strung up I forget to serve one of the courses. We don't have stair carpet yet. A kind guest says, "We've just recarpeted from top to bottom. You're awfully welcome to have our old one." "That's terribly sweet of you, but actually we ordered our carpet weeks ago and it still hasn't arrived." Tim is really pleased with me. He promises to go to the second place first thing tomorrow for a remnant. The disasters continue until we've cleared the backlog of returned invitations. I cringe at the times I underestimate the amount of meat or potatoes. I giggle when the moussaka doesn't defrost in time and our guests are practically rolling around the sitting room awash with sherry. How does one become the perfect hostess? I save my cigarette coupons and eventually have enough for a hostess tray. That should solve my problems, if I remember to switch it on early enough. Dear God, I am a nervous wreck. I desperately need some magic. Would you believe, the television camera has discovered this rather pretty town. It's becoming a local industry, especially as costume drama is very much in vogue. I am discovered by an intense young director who says I should renew my equity card. Tim agrees this would widen my horizons and improve our finances. So here I am, Lizzie, saving lots of money for the TV companies, travel, accommodation, etc., playing laundry woman with 6 lines, lady-in-waiting with 2 lines, lady of the manor with 4 lines. My dialects swing from "ooh-ar" to "where's the pain to, my dear?" More importantly, I'm gaining a bit of a name for myself, not in television, of course, at the dining table. I can now say, as I do, quite modestly, "It's awfully difficult, of course, with small children, but I'm doing my level best to keep my hand in." We're not quite in the middle of the table anymore. We've moved up a couple of places, which means that Tim is further away from me as he gets nearer the captain's wife, and I get nearer the captain. Mrs. Captain now takes my arm and says, "Have you met Mattie? She's our star." "Don't be such a tease," I say, mirroring her tone exactly. It's terribly important that I don't lose my sense of perspective. And I am. I know that I am. Lizzie, you should hear me. Terribly, awfully, dreadfully, factfully. It's becoming second nature, and I don't know what to do. The other day I said Oxford. I did. I've even said Edwardian. Very soon I'm going to turn into my friend Henrietta, the frightfully posh one, you remember, an honourable, who said that her fudge had turned into toffee. "That's a bit off," I said without thinking. Little bits of vulgarity slip out when I'm caught unawares, like the day I met the padre in the supermarket pondering over a bottle of bleach. "Cleansing your soul, Daibach." We've graduated to dinner at the captain's. Black tie. The invitation arrives by internal post with yesterday's copy of The Guardian. Our availability is checked out before the card arrives, so it's just poor memoir. "Tim, what shall I wear?" It has to be long and cover the tops of my arms. I wouldn't mind if it covered everything and made me completely invisible. Dinner is a different ball game. "Apparently the guests of honour take precedence," says Tim. "When the wife stands, you stand. You let them go first into dinner, and you can't leave before they do." Thank goodness he omits to tell me that the chief guests are an admiral and his wife from the Ministry of Defence. They are accompanied by an army major who is the aide-de-camp. It's fairly straightforward until a lull after the pudding. Then there's a loud bang. I leap a couple of feet from my chair. The captain has banged a mallet on the table. "Ladies and gentlemen, the Queen." We say, the Queen. And then he says, you may now smoke. And we're sitting down. None of that chair scraping as everyone staggers to their feet. This establishment is described as a ship. On ships, you don't stand for the loyal toast. Something to do with one of the Georges. Second, probably, who saw that sailors bang their heads on the beams when they stood up. Magic again. The stewards are there with cigarette boxes and the port is passed. I watch carefully so that I can do it correctly. Mrs. Admiral has a giggle in her voice. Someone's asked her if she enjoys all the travelling she has to do. Fortunately, from captain level onwards, one has the same issue mattress. So I sleep like a log. The only disadvantage is that I wake thinking I'm in my own bed at home. The aide-de-camp turns to me. We call these visits one-night stands. I have visions of admirals' wives picking out swords and telescopes instead of keys at the end of a drunken party. He's 30-ish and straight out of Woman's Own, handsome with wavy hair and a square chin. Do you find it odd to be assigned to the Navy? Don't you find it rather quaint? He recognizes my tongue in cheek. He lowers his voice. Another year, and I'm out. I want to see the world in my own way. Australia, perhaps. Thought I'd don scruffy jeans and become a backpacker. It's hard to believe he's so elegant. Can I come too? I ask. My jeans are a disgrace. He seems to like me. I know I have at least a pound of plums in my mouth, but it's a dream. I envy you. But you can't talk like that in Oz. I could give you lessons on how to talk Romford. Later, when we ladies have powdered our noses and the gentlemen have had their session over more port, the aide-de-camp sits with me again. Before Mrs. Captain Spitz is up, in the musical chairs exercise to make everyone mingle, he says, there'll be yet another parade tomorrow morning. And you'll be 10 paces behind the Admiral. He lowers his voice, like one of the Queen's corgis. You must find it very tedious. He nods. I play little games to pass the time. Tell me, please, what do you do? I've never met such a character as this at the captain's house. I leave off bits of my uniform, or wear the wrong combinations, the wrong trousers, or minus my spurs, or my Sam Brown. I play games, too, but only in my head. When the band strikes up with a popular song, I have this urge to sashay down the steps in a ball gown and foxtrot up and down the divisions. My partner has a number on his back, of course. Before he can respond, I'm wrenched away by Mrs. Captain, who thinks I'm being monopolized. I've lost all that weight I put on when I had the children. It means I can wear younger-looking clothes. The coughs and spits I get in films and TV can now include glamorous waitress, rich young widow. I work occasionally for the local television company, filling in on continuity. It's so good to be more financially independent. I'm more in demand for teaching, too, now that the children are both at school. Tim has joined the Open University so that he can stretch himself and not become a cabbage. I'm really pleased for him. Mrs. Captain Mark III invited us to dinner. She'd only been here a couple of weeks, so it was really quite soon for us to get an invitation. I rushed to my favourite frock shop in town. The adventurous owner, a one-time fashion editor on a woman's magazine, showed me a collection she bought from the local Polly. The third-year student's exam pieces. I chose a flowing lawn frock with handkerchief pleats, low neck, very comfortable, very cheap and unique. No one in the world had a frock like this. Head held high, I walked into the sitting room feeling the best ever. Mrs. Captain knew who we were. The steward had just announced us, quietly. She smiled nervously and tried to introduce us to the other guests, but she couldn't remember their names. "We've met everyone," I said, and chanted on about how each captain's wife stamps her own personality on the sitting room. This one is into chinoiserie and samplers. She latched on to me until it was time to go into the dining room. We were even higher up the table, I noticed. Have I ever said that a steward helps each of the ladies to her seat? They pull the chair back, and when it's time to sit, they guide it back into place. So I sat, and my frock slid down my arms and crumpled around my waist. And since I'm so flat-chested and don't need a bra, I was utterly bare. Luckily, everyone was in the process of sitting, so they didn't notice as I hoisted my frock up. I realized immediately that it could happen again any second. Why hadn't I practiced sitting down in it? I crossed my arms and pulled the cap sleeves as close to my neck as I could. Then I hunched my shoulders and ate my dinner with great difficulty, my arms pressed hard against my ribs. My steward caught my eye and kind of winked. Mrs. Captain was mumbling at the top of the table, and I wished I was wearing a sensible frock like her. When we retreated upstairs, I found a safety pin in my bag and secured the frock firmly with a huge tuck. Oh, Lizzie. Lizzie, will I ever get it right? Strange how, when we think we've failed, we've actually won. Mrs. Captain thinks I'm wonderful. She's put me on the chapel flowers rota. We don't go to chapel. I don't arrange flowers. I cannot refuse this honour. Tim arranges our flowers, so I ask for his guidance. Cut half an inch off the stems to keep them fresh. Choose flowers that don't clash and use plenty of greenery. I feel I've done quite well until Tim arrives, gown billowing around him. Good Lord, they look like acts of God. Mrs. Captain arrives on the scene and compliments me on my simple but tasteful arrangement. Nevertheless, I'm never asked again. Tim is just back from his first Open University summer school. He's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. He's met like-minded people, stimulus with a capital S. Apart from the formal invitations that we must accept for brownie points, well, I suppose there are some people who don't, but they're not ambitious. Tim absents himself more and more from parties and jolly get-togethers with real friends. You go, he says. I've got an assignment. I've got to look at this module. He also wants to look at the OU magazine, the personal page where flubby Mrs. Pugwash and Euclid is worried about his little equation. Whoever she is. Mrs. Captain Mark IV is into bronzes, nude blokes with wings, and leader wrestling with a thoroughly butch swan. I can't make out whether the bronze bird in the middle of the table is a pheasant or a turkey. It's surrounded with sweet-smelling herbs, all very artistic, so it's probably a turkey. But enough of that. I've made a big decision, Lizzie. I've decided that I should brush up on world affairs. So I buy a dictionary of politics. It goes from absolutism to Zionism. And I feel it's going to change my life. We'd met a retired captain and his wife at one dinner. He said, I always rehearse at least three topics of conversation before a dinner party. She said she preferred to talk about her travels. In fact, she said, we've just got back from Joburg. I don't know what the fuss is all about. I didn't see a black face the whole time I was there. The invitation arrives for dinner at the captain's house, together with a guest list. Now, that's something new. When I read it, I realize why. The guests of honor are Argentinian naval attachés and their wives. Tim compliments me on my purchase of the Dictionary of Politics, and we both read up on Argentina. I am determined not to talk about beef or the tango, which is all I know about the place. I find myself between two officers at dinner, an Argentinian and a Scotsman. Tim is next to the Argentinian wives, but since they don't speak English, he talks to the husband of one of them. The Scotsman is a submariner and doesn't stop talking. Months underwater would have the same effect on me, I suppose. He's thrilled with his new baby and how much he's grown in 6 weeks. Eventually, I turn to the Argentinian and smile. How are your oil wells doing? He's bemused. I didn't know we had any. Across the table, Tim says, I gather you bought the rail network from us after the war. The Argentinian bristles. It was the worst deal ever. It should never have happened that way. What now? Is the tango a favourite dance? Do you get fed up with beef? To my horror, he takes out his cigarette case and offers me a cigarette. I look helplessly at the captain. Do you have a problem, Matty, dear? Senor... Captain, I squint at his place name. He would like to smoke. The captain bangs his mallet. The Queen, we respond. The Queen, he says, you may smoke. The stewards have been caught off guard. Mrs. Captain conceals her anger. The pudding plates are still on the table. Where's the magic? We wander upstairs after dinner to powder our noses. No one ever says to have a pee. Mrs. Captain puts me into a bedroom with adjoining bathroom with the two Argentinian ladies. They have obviously been bored out of their heads all night. I let them use the bathroom before I do. When I return, one of them is sitting at the dressing table, actually powdering her nose. The other makes a big effort. You speak a Spanish? No. She looks very disappointed. I have this desperate urge to please her. I remember a speech from Empire Day. It's the only Spanish I know. They smile encouragingly, so I begin. Ninos y ninas de todas naciones. Nosotros, los ninos y ninas de Gales, los saludamos. Total silence. Then one of them laughs out loud. The other one can't believe it. Again. I say it again, and she shrieks like a fishwife. Again. By the time Mrs. Captain comes into the room, they're rolling helplessly on the floor. What are you doing, Matty? She's wonderful. She speak a good Spanish. The hysterics take off again. As we go downstairs, Mrs. Captain congratulates me on having such a rapport with them. I knew I could rely on you, she says. I don't tell her that what I said was. Boys and girls of all nations, we, the boys and girls of Wales, salute you. You can tell Josh that these days we're well up the table for dinner. I'm second down from the captain and Tim second down from Mrs. Captain. Occasionally it's the other way round, which is when I discover that there's a bell fixed to the base of the table. Mrs. Captain presses it with her knee when she wants the stewards to come in. Ah. And I feel more able to cope. I don't compete anymore. I can say... We moved down here from a scruffy attic flat in Shepherd's Bush. Or when I actually catch myself doing it, I'll say, just listen to me saying awfully. If my Welsh grandma could hear me, she'd slap my wrist with a wooden spoon. I now stress my cuckoo element. Pure peasant, that's my background. I'm a mimic. I'm a minor bird. I pick up the nuances of my environment. I'm in the wrong nest. I've become novelty value, so I know I can say what I like. Who is my better half? I have no better half. I am me in my entirety. If you're talking about my husband, he's on the captain's left, second down. And I gulp my soup with as much noise as possible. Everyone else does. Tim says, you've changed, Matty. You don't seem to care. You seem to say the first thing that comes into your head. Sorry. I say sorry a lot. It's the easy option. Except, of course, it leaves me permanently in the wrong. Britannia rules the waves and Thatcher is on the warpath. There's excitement in the air. The services are going to be able to put their training into practice. Our Navy will play a vital role. I think that Tim would like to put me in quarantine for the duration. But the invitations to dinner at the captain's still adorn the mantelpiece. We're asked to a private dinner where the captain and his wife will be present, together with assorted retired admirals, gentlemen farmers, and pillars of the county. Tim says, Matty. He stops and then says, never mind. I know he wants me to watch my tongue. Sod that. What a beautiful evening. The sun is just beginning to set beyond the ha-ha. The admiral, a past captain who I've always liked, stands with me near the sprinkler. You two look like Nelson and Emma in front of the fountain, says our host. Don't interrupt, says the admiral. Matty and I are having an intelligent conversation. Matty's a pinko. You shouldn't listen to a word, she says. She's one of Ben's mob. I'm a Welsh nationalist, I say, and anyway I approve of oddballs like Ben and Enoch in Parliament. Keeps everyone on their toes. The admiral swiftly moves on. I love the rig, Matty. You always wear such stylish clothes. Does he remember the infamous frock? Did he see? Don't say rig, says our host. A rig is a castrated ram. Someone seems to have a hotline to Northwood. We get news of the war 24 hours before anyone else. At the dining table, the Navy keeps quiet. Very sensible, very honourable. The pillars of the county hold forth. There's no question about it. The Arge is a bit north, more than they can chew. They'll get the hiding they deserve. He looks such a nice man. His wife nods her head. Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Numbers of dead are reeled off. Statistics, ship's losses, who might be court-martialed. It's too much. Tim's expression is one of pleading. He doesn't want me to say anything. I can't help it. I'm confused about the war. They all look at me kindly. I mean, I can't convince myself that it was entirely necessary. I feel sure that they were very near to us, a settlement. Playing for time, says a gentleman farmer. But don't you feel there's a terrible cynicism on both sides about the loss of young lives? Why do I always blush? I do understand about expendable losses, but I mean, the idea of sending the young Argentinian conscripts to Darwin and keeping the most experienced for Port Stanley. As ever, I trail off. I can't cope with being the centre of attention, and they're still looking kindly at me. Our host proposes a toast to the sailors. And I mean our sailors. I mutter, to every mother's son. Later, as we ladies sip coffee in the sitting room, I drop in on a conversation about juries. The retired admiral's wife reckons there shouldn't be coloured jurors. I leap up. Oh, Lord, I forgot to powder my nose. Do excuse me. As we drive home, Tim says, I'm pleased you're more communicative these days. I breathe a sigh of relief. But I do think you should be more gentle with people who have hard-held beliefs. Okay. And can I ask you, please, please, not to join CND? Right, I say, and feel assured of a peaceful Sunday. Mrs. Captain Mark V, or is it Mark VI, I'm losing track, has had the sitting room walls painted a deep salmon colour, very trendy. She has a couple of Hockneys and a Mondrian Manquet. There are definite signs of forward movement in the Navy. Coffee mornings are becoming a thing of the past because more of the wives have jobs. We've moved to a house that doesn't have a dining room. Everyone eats in the kitchen. It's such a relief. We sent the candelabra, the walnut dining table, the everything-must-match dinner service to auction, and had our first foreign holiday since the children were born. I don't forget to serve a course anymore, because there it is on the worktop, and someone is sure to spot whatever it is. The saucepans pile up high, the empty bottles litter the floor, and no one seems to mind. After all these years, I've discovered that every new captain is given a rogues gallery of all the personnel and spouses in the establishment. Somehow, I've always managed to avoid having my photograph taken. I think it's because Tim is agnostic and we don't go to chapel. The photo sessions happen on Sundays in the wardroom anteroom. The new captain prides himself he knows everyone, from the apprentice gardener to the chief steward, and all of us, of course, except me. I keep meeting him at cocktail parties, and so far he's assumed I'm a petty officer's wife, one of the librarians, and the commander's wife's nanny. He launches in with, "You've travelled from Portsmouth, haven't you?" Or, "How do you think the new system is working in the library? Is computerization the answer, do you think?" And I haven't the heart to spoil his 100% success in the knowing everyone stakes. When we go to dinner at his house, he's deeply confused. I think we must have met in another life, Matty. Very likely. I should feel monumentally depressed. My face is obviously like some nondescript wallpaper, or like the emulsion in the room, a deep salmon pink. Not a bit of it, it's just that I have a very mobile, expressive face. I feel bolshy. I eat the ornamental prawn on top of the mousse, and tease the chaplain of the fleet, who used to be here years ago. How do you manage to keep your stockings up, Daibach? He remembers my irreverence and relaxes. Look, he says, turning his leg prettily and showing off his buckled shoe, not a wrinkle in sight. I learned the trick from a judge. He wears maternity tights to accommodate the paunch. The trouble is, the hairs on one's legs stick through the nylon. Not a pretty sight. So one wears two pairs of tights, and hey presto. I laugh out loud. The Joey Brown wheeze is gone, and I guffaw like the best of them. Thank you for coming, Lizzie. I need you. Tonight, I declined an invitation to go upstairs with the ladies. I don't use powder. The captain's wife suggested that I wait in the sitting room where a steward would bring me coffee. I don't suppose you've got a horse's neck handy, have you? The steward obliged, and I spent a quiet time admiring the artwork. Very soon, another wife joined me. Mrs. Captain, Mark 3 or 4. Her husband, now a vice admiral, is guest of honor. I didn't want to sit on a bed gossiping. This is much more civilized. She, too, was offered a drink. We were almost tempted to ask for cigars. Another time, maybe. Except there won't be other times. After tonight. Her smile was genuine. Matty, dear, it's lovely to see you. And you, I said, meaning it. She asked after the children and Tim and my work, and are you still happy to be here? Should I tell her? I looked her straight in the eye. Tomorrow I'm leaving. Tim and I are separating. It's all very amicable. She didn't know what to say. I'd broken one of the rules. I'm not sure which one. But her crestfallen expression suggested I'd put her in a difficult position. So I took charge. Tell me all about you. Did I hear that you'd let your house to Americans and they'd cut the fringes off your Persian rugs to make them look less untidy? Oh, Lizzie.
In The Captain's Wife by Juliet Ace, Matty was played by Patricia Hodge, and the director was Ned Shine.